Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Quintessential Listening Poetry Online Radio and YouTube Podcast, streamed live from the heart of Washington, D.C. Here, you'll find a portal to vibrant voices, echoing souls, and an ongoing celebration of the extraordinary power of language. So, prepare yourself to join host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram and his special guests as they explore traditional and spoken word forms of poetry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. I'm thrilled to have you join us today for what promises to be an engaging and insightful conversation. My guests today are two individuals
Hello.
Whose talents okay. span across different artistic realms. First, we have esteemed author and poet Bill Cushing, whose latest work, Correct Brothers of the Civil War, has been captivating readers with his gripping narrative as well as poignant. Bill will treat us to some exclusive readings from the book. Additionally, we'll be joined by the incredibly talented musician, Chuck Comisario, whose melodies have a unique way of touching the soul. These two collaborated. As poet, writer, and musician, and this collaboration led to the publishing of a chapbook, Notes and Letters. I'd like to welcome them to my program, to this program, to our program, but first, sit back, relax, and prepare to be inspired as we delve into the worlds of literature and music with our extraordinary guests, Bill and Chuck. Welcome.
Hey, Mike, are we coming through okay?
Yes, you're fine. You're fine. It's good to hear you. All right. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
All right. Speak just a little bit, if you can.
I'm sorry?
Speak up just a little.
Okay. Let me get closer.
All right.
All right. How's it coming now?
Now, that's a lot better. Thank you. Thank you, my friend. That's a lot better. All right. Chuck, this is your first trip to the program. How are you?
Oh, very good. Thank you. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Thanks, Mike.
Yes. Let's start this journey today. Literary journey with your collaboration. How did that come about, the two of you working together?
You want to go ahead?
Well, Bill and I grew up in New York. I lived across the street from Bill, but he was about 7 or 8 years older than me. And when I was about 10 in 1970, Bill moved away. But before that, I used to watch Bill and his friend, and they used to have a band. They used to play together, and I invited them to play at my house. And that's how I was inspired to play the guitar, by watching Bill and his friend, Rob Ward. And so what happened was I had a concert in my garage one day, and Bill and Rob played there, and I sold drinks, lemonade, and made money. And then I had my first experience listening to music live. And then all of a sudden, when I was 10, Bill moved away. And then fast forward to 2016, I was living in Los Angeles, and Bill messaged me on Facebook and asked me if I was the same Chuck that lived across the street, and I said, yes, that's me. Anyway, he invited me to his book opening on La Brea in Los Angeles at Muse Bookstore, and the rest is history. I asked him when I was leaving if he would be interested in having me collaborate with him, me playing my jazz improvisations on guitar and him doing his poetry, and that was the beginning of Notes and Letters. This was 2016, but we hadn't seen each other for about, 40-some-odd years.
Wow.
And then we reconnected.
Story.
Yeah.
Right. Bill,
let me let Bill expand on that.
All right.
Well, not much to add to it, I don't think. But it was the idea, yeah, Chuck came up with this idea, that, hey, let's collaborate. I can improvise and you can read your stuff. And so we've been performing, you know, whenever he's in town, we try and set up gigs, or he'll actually come in, because he bounces back and forth between here and New York.
Yes.
And, you know, we try and set up, like, we just got through doing, what, 3 or 4 gigs in the last few weeks at the Lit Fest, and we performed. We actually did a thing. There's a program here in town for disabled folks, and we did a thing with them and had a great time. Those guys really loved. They read their kids would read their own work, and Chuck would play along. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun though.
But it must for you, Bill, feel I guess really nice to know that someone wanted to emulate you. You know, in terms
oh, I know.
Of-
well, that's. In fact, that's one of the things I said is that I'm glad I inspired Chuck to get into music, but I'm sure glad he didn't take any lessons from me because I don't have much to offer there.
Okay. All right. So blending poetry with guitar music, talk about that. I mean, how does that vision come to life when you merge in spoken word and music?
It's fun because a lot of times, like, well, we started with the musically oriented stuff, but we try and match the music to whatever the theme of the poem is. For example, well, obviously with the Miles Davis poem, we used some Miles melodies I'm trying to think of some of the other stuff. Well, Cusqueños, which is my poem about the indigenous people of Peru.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we use some Peruvian music there, that kind of thing. I'm trying to think. But we try and fit it in with, you know, for example, we use Take the A-Train on a couple of poems about Los Angeles. You may remember the poem in Pink Neon about the all-night diner, and Chuck plays a variation of Black Coffee on that. So, yeah, I mean, it's not a strict interpretation or a strict replaying, but just dovetailing off of the main melody.
All right. Well, would you both share something for us with us?
Yeah, let me see. Hopefully this will come through okay. We'll see how it goes. You want to do the mic up so you can very close to you. Okay. You want to do the Pelicans?
Yeah.
That's a short one. Okay, so this is, if I can find it now. And we do have a chapbook that's associated with the stuff we do. 17. So this is the poem Pelicans. Okay, whenever you're ready. Slowly circling, the pelican drops like a stone into water. Then climbing the air, he stops and with a single motion of wings, glides on the wind. I don't know how good the mix was on that.
It sounded great.
Okay.
Great.
It really did.
We're really winging it.
Hey, we all are. Please share another. Please share another.
Sure, absolutely.
Or the Miles Davis.
Yeah, so we'll do the Charlie Parker one. Okay, so this is my poem about Charlie Parker, and it's called Listening to Bird. Flying through scales, he did the impossible. Stretching staccato sounds, stopping only to change direction. He found places in his search for every note not imagined, leaving chromatic gravity, breaking confines, shooting up into infinity. Then he rested, hanging on a single random chord, bending branches of music but never breaking them, lingering wherever he chose, staying just long enough to make it his territory and his alone.
As you think about working together, what are some of the challenges that you faced in terms of combining poetry and music, and how did you overcome them?
Well, I think one of the reasons we do fairly well is it's not set. I mean, obviously my words are already written, but the music isn't set in stone. So, you know, we're able to, or Chuck is able to adjust to whatever the situation is. You know, if the acoustics aren't that good, he can, you know, play around with the instrumentation, I assume, that sort of thing. Obviously, like, one of the most fun ones we did was we got invited to play at the Bolton Museum up in Sunland, Tuhunga here, and it's an old, old building, and the acoustics were so good at that one. We actually broke out the bass fiddle for that. So, yeah, we try and adjust. A lot of times we'll check out the spot we're going to be playing before we go there.
Try to check out the spot where you'll be playing prior to,
yeah,
to your set?
See what the acoustics are like, that kind of thing.
Okay, all right. So what are your thoughts? How do you work together?
Oh, this is Chuck. You know, from a musical perspective and jazz improvisation, I view it as a language, music, especially jazz, as a dialect. So they say, you know, music is the universal language. I also view poetry as a universal language, rhythmically. When we were working with the disabled children, they were doing haikus, and you could see they connected immediately with each other's poetry. It was very similar to music. So when I listen to a poem as a musician, I'm hearing these motifs in my head, almost as like synesthesia. I'm like you see, you hear in colors.
Yes.
Well, I'm hearing in words sometimes, so it inspires me, my rhythm or my phrasing. At a certain point, when I'm here, trying to match up the music emotionally, so that's how I do it. It's very intuitive and it's hard to describe, but it's definitely like a language for me.
So was it built from kids immediately when you first started collaborating in terms of the of combining both, or you both had to kind of massage it as you continued with time?
Yes, What we did was second Sunday. We were going every 2 weeks to the studio in North Hollywood, and Bill would give me an idea of the material ahead of time, which poems we were going to do, and I would adjust to Bill, and then also to the acoustics and the audience each time. And then as we perform more and more, I found I was like kind of, I would get in the pocket more, you know, like we say, you know, when you perform, the band was swinging, you know.
Yeah.
Try to get like swing going between me and Bill. And it took a while to develop for us. It did.
For you, I mean, have you worked with someone in the past from a musical perspective?
I'd only worked with singers, and I had also, you know, I'm an accompanist, so I freelance.
Okay.
So I have to, when you accompany a singer, especially a jazz singer, they have their little idiosyncrasies and things that you have to be aware of to complement them. And poetry is very similar. And even when I accompany some of the other poets, the children, I have to really listen. And I think when you first start, you have to give a lot of space as a musician. Because if there's no space, then you can't respond. So, but this, Bill was really the first poet I'd ever worked with.
Wow. So for you, Bill, had you worked with others in the past?
It's
other
funny,
musicians?
Actually, when I was in Jacksonville, there was, and he's still out there, Arvid Smith was a musician. And like Chuck, he approached me one time. I was at a reading, and he came up, and he and I used to, we played a couple of churches, some museums, stuff like that, and actually were able to do a couple of literary events as well. So I had done this before to a degree with this musician in Jacksonville. So it wasn't really new territory for me, but, yeah, it was great being invited to do that again.
So the poetry itself, is it already written, or are you writing it at the same time that you're both working together in terms of the collaboration?
No, I've written the poems, actually. I mean, many of them, well, we have that little chapbook that is sort of the standard playlist, the notes and letters book. But we've since expanded out of that a little bit with some of the other stuff. Recently, I've been doing a lot of poems about growing up in New York and our neighborhood, so we've started doing some of that. It's all really fluid in a lot of ways.
So you've created joint pieces then together?
Yeah, to the degree that, I mean, here again, I write the poem, that's already sort of set, and then Chuck will look at it and say, okay, I think this will work, or it won't work, or here's the piece that will go with that, that kind of thing.
Please share a couple more. I'd love to hear some more.
What do we got here? Let's do the Pink Neon. Since I've got the book here. Trying to find it here. And this is actually, I always love doing this one because it's really the first serious poem I ever wrote. And it's by the way, and to let anybody listening know, we do have a YouTube channel where much of this stuff is on there. But this is in Pink Neon. Chrome and black tile at breakfast again. Coffee so strong it pulls your eyelids back, going down. And while last evening's drunks with 5 a.m. shadows use it to try to face the new day, women, legs on spiked heels, lift leather skirts to reveal specialties of the house, initiating a physical negotiation, trading the tangible for currency. Enclosed cuffed hand, scaling triangle of whole wheat drips from sunny side up. A single waitress covers ground, butter warmed by sun, shining through slatted glass, slowly rolls down a stack of brown pancakes. Silverware clatters, china against china, napkin falls, voices chatter, while outside in pink neon, a sign glows, best food in town, and it is. And it occurred to me while I was going through that, and I don't know how many other people, other poets, one of the greatest descriptions of the poetry I ever heard was that a good poem should appear like a movie, should appear cinematic. Right. And I think that's one of the things that I like about doing this. Is it's almost like having a soundtrack or a score along with the, you know, whatever the poem is about.
I like that. Please share another. Share another.
Well, what do we got here? All right, well, this is slightly longer, but this is the one that got us started.
All right, love to hear.
This is the Miles Davis piece. And the title is actually a quote from Miles. It's, "Music isn't about standing still and being safe. Listen. 2 weeks after you died, a 250,000 thronged by the St. John's River to hear the music you had spawned. hoping to see you, but even in death, you never look back. They were all there. Hannibal, Bird, Chick, JoJo, Red, Jocko, Bean, Dizzy, my favorite, Freddie Freeloader. Isolated, you were a beacon, a flagship for messages of the heart. Back to the crowd, unbowed, that proud dance walk, announced by muted horn that spoke and broke through all the bull and told us about a place miles ahead of everyone else. You spent a lifetime thinking for yourself, speaking to every generation, playing it all, jazz, blues, funk, rock, fusion. Categories took a back seat to creativity and rhythm, space and feeling, spirits. I remember fourth grade, picking up a horn, then laying it down. Rock and roll was my world. What did I know? 7 years later, I heard it was in the garden where you brought me back to music. I walked all the way home, miles from that train station, my head pounding with sounds, frantic fast as the subway I spent the night on. Those African rhythms you used decades before anyone else even thought to, filling my head, letting me know I'd have it all down cold if I could walk as cool as the notes you heard coming from miles. You had that thing, that style, that spark that was a blue flame jumping off a gas stove, igniting everything everywhere, touching the genetic resonant frequency in all.
Do either of you have any rituals or practices that you that help you get into the creative zone together?
I don't know. Breakfast?
Breakfast?
Yeah, we tend to get together and plan things over a meal.
Well, that'll do.
Yeah.
That'll do. So in terms of your work together so far, which collaborative piece are you most proud of and why?
I really love doing the Cusqueños poem just because it's associated with my wife and because she's Peruvian. And, it, you know, I think a lot of people like that poem. So that one I've enjoyed doing a lot. Of the newer stuff, there is a new one that is called it's called First Work, which is about an old man in our neighborhood that I worked for as a kid, and then Chuck kind of stepped in and took over my job when I left.
Okay. All right.
So
all right.
That's been a fun one to play with.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's. I mean, I don't know if he has any preferences. Do you have a favorite?
I really like the piece we just did, the Miles Davis piece.
Mm-hmm.
When Bill, that was one of the first poems Bill showed me. And I remember when I went to college, I went to CCNY, CUNY, CCNY is the campus up in Harlem. And I studied arranging with Gil Evans one semester. He was the artist in residence. And he had been the arranger for Miles Davis and on quite a few albums, but Sketches of Spain. And I remember when we did a performance, Gil said to me, he says, now, listen, you're Chuck Corbusiero. You're not Wes Montgomery. You're not Joe Pass. Tonight you're Chuck Corbusiero, he says, and I want to hear you, because we were doing a Jimi Hendrix a piece, and I was playing guitar with the big band, and Miles had done a whole album of Hendrix music.
Mm-hmm.
So the tendency for a jazz guitar player is to be very, you know, introverted and play quietly. And Gil, before the concert, he told me, he goes, now I want to hear you, you know. And so I really stretched out on the solo that I had a pretty long solo. And after the concert, the reviews were really great on the piece that I did, and I always stuck with me, you know. So when Bill wanted to do the Miles Davis piece, I was really excited about it.
All right, all So as you think about combining poetry and music, how do you think it enhances the way people view both poetry and music in terms of bringing them together?
I personally think it does because, like when I go and I accompany Bill at the at most of the poetry recitals that we go to, there's mm-hmm. no other musicians there, and it's like, and then I can see the poets are really intrigued by it. So it's like, and I say to myself, you know, when I go to a jazz jam session, there's all these musicians. There's no poets there. But when I go to a poetry session, there's no musicians. So when I'm there, I'm the only one. So I feel like, you know, I'm like, I feel kind of, and then people will come up to me and ask me to accompany them, you know. So it's like a whole other thing because everybody else is just playing the same material in jazz. You know, they're just playing jazz standards, American Songbook. There's a lot of approximating, too, of people's heroes. You know, they try to almost copy them. But when I play guitar with a poet, it's almost like the poet is letting me off the hook because I get to kind of stretch out and I let them take over. You know, and I'm by myself. There's no other musicians. So it's an interesting, for me, it's an interesting, I think it does attract musicians and poets.
All right. Your thoughts, Bill?
Well, let's say I enjoy it because it lends, like I say, sort of a soundtrack to my own words. Mm-hmm. And I think it helps the visuals of whatever I'm, you know, writing about. And I do tend to think that my stuff is mostly visual. I'm not a very abstract poet. I'm pretty concrete. So
okay.
That opportunity to add to the vision of whatever the image or the memory or whatever it is, I think, only adds to what I've done.
You know, it takes a lot of intestinal fortitude to step outside of comfort zone and add music to poetry or vice versa. So what advice would either of you or both of you give to other artists who are attempting to blend different art forms like poetry and music?
Oh, God, I don't know. I mean, I guess for me, you know, don't be too afraid of playing around. I think I was just thinking, we did one presentation several years ago, and it was great because we were in a space where they had projection, and we brought visual images to go along with what we were doing. So we were able to read, play, and then show pictures associated with, which is kind of what we're doing with the YouTube channel, because anybody who goes to that YouTube channel will see that we have a montage of images and pictures that go along with whatever the theme of the poem is. So, I mean, it's to me, it's a way to cut loose. I mean, I don't feel hemmed in any way. It's one of those where, all right, if something doesn't work, we bag it, and if it works, we expand on it. I don't know.
From a musical standpoint,
yes.
I think I have to listen, really listen to the poet and to Bill. And then sometimes the only criticism of myself is that I need to give more space. And that's the hardest thing, using space as a musician. So, it's nothing to be afraid of. But if you hear a lot of these young musicians now, just forget about poetry, just playing, they don't use space. They're obsessed with technique and playing a million notes as fast as they can and impressing each other, but none of them deal with space and or with tonality. I call it my tone. I try to take a tone with the poem, and that's the one thing that I would say when you work with a poet, you have to use space and then create a tonality that helps the poet and helps the poem.
So where do you both go from here creatively? What's next for you two in terms of collaborations?
Well, that's a good one. Here again, I don't know. I haven't really even thought of it. I mean, it's just this is something we do mostly just for the fun of it whenever we can. So it's, you know, there's no vision involved. There's no end game involved other than obviously there's self-promotion going on. But it's also, it's fun to do. Like I say, this last thing, well, not just the thing we did with the local group, but the Lit Fest we did where we had a couple of poets come up and they read their material and Chuck played along with them. So that's been sort of a new wrinkle. And we did a little bit at the coffee house, too.
Yeah.
So, inviting audience members up now has been, I guess, the new big thing. But it's not like we have any goal in mind other than just get together and have fun.
Well, one thing that I'd like you to do to think about is that on this particular podcast, now that we've moved into Zoom YouTube world, I offer these poetry lovers concerts. And I'd like you two to think about being guests on that, being featured.
Oh, well, yeah. Let us know.
No questions.
We may have to go to different
maybe
locations.
One or two, but it's primarily just your sharing your work, a poetry lovers concert.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you know, we're always open to that. And we have done it from distant locations, I guess.
Yeah, we need to use a special app.
Yeah, so it's usually easier if the two of us are together.
Yes.
Because like I said, Chuck bounces back and forth between here and New York. I'm pretty much here for the duration.
All right. Well, before we close this particular set, would you favor us with one more before we go?
Yeah, let's do that. What do you want to do, though? Well, I think you're going to, it's 12:02 now.
Okay. You want to do Goose Games?
You want to do the, let's do the first work. This is one of the new ones, and like I say, this is a true story, and this is about the neighborhood where we grew up. So this is first work. At 10, I sought my first paycheck from Mr. Kunstler, the old man across the street wheezing on a porch stoop, laid low by emphysema. I'd hear his body struggle, trying to sing songs he'd sung when young, now chained to heavy tanks to inflate lungs. Each Saturday, he'd sit behind a roll-top desk, retrieve his ledger to sign the check I earned dragging two metal trash cans to the curb three times a week. When needed, I cut the grass, shoveled snow from the walk. His signature scrawled and jagged, the only flourish he had left in him. But a half century before, he'd been a warrior, a Basque who'd fought Franco, an armed fury riding horseback through the forest or across mountains that spanned the Spanish border. On days he wasn't hindered by breathlessness, he'd recall those years, invading the plains, then sleeping on stone beds, or hiding huddled around clandestine fires, set after scaling those coastal steps. Once he croaked the words, Askatasuna ita Giralda, freedom and country. And in that moment, his face brightened, his back straightened, and he seemed to shed age. Often, my job's done, his wife of 60 years sat with me at their kitchen table. She poured homemade lemonade, fed me pieces of burnt cheesecake. From our country, she'd say, her aged eyes fixed on her own distant memory. After he died, she tripled my pay to thank me for returning her husband a measure of pride.
I'd like to thank the both of you. Chuck, thank you so much for joining in today.
Oh, thank you. It was our pleasure.
Very, very nice. Very, very nice. We're going to segue now. No, first, before we segue, where can we purchase Notes and Letters? Where can they be purchased?
Well,
the chapbook?
It is available on Amazon or through Lulu, but we have some signed copies. If anybody wants to get them directly, we'll work out a deal, and they can use that email that you have from me, the Pisces Poet.
All right, fantastic. And so PiscesPoet@yahoo.com, right?
Yeah, the PiscesPoet@yahoo.com, yeah.
All right. Well, again, I wish you both the best, and I will be in touch in terms of scheduling, hopefully maybe before the end of the year, a Poetry Lovers concert featuring Bill Cushing.
Yeah, we'll find out when Chuck's back in town and get something set up.
I look forward to it, Mike. That's very generous of you. Thank you.
Yes, you're great guys. Wonderful. So now what we're going to do is kind of segue into the second part of this program. So I know you as a poet primarily. So when you shared that you'd written a book, history book about the Civil War, I was shocked. So, in a good way. How did that come about, making that shift?
Well, actually, it's interesting because, first of all, I was named after one of the characters in the book. These are both the two protagonists, so to speak. I mean, it is nonfiction. They are cousins of mine, fifth cousins. But I was actually named in honor of one of them. So I always grew up with his stories. Then later on, who was William, and then Lonnie or Alonzo, who is the older brother, I got involved years ago. They were trying to get him the Medal of Honor because of, you know, how he had died at the Battle of Gettysburg during Pickett's Charge, and a lot of people were saying, hey, this guy should get the Medal of Honor. And so I was involved in a, you know, trying to promote that. And then once it was achieved, I mean, they finally, I guess it was 2014, he finally got the medal. At that point, I went, you know what, these guys, I mean, the stories about the two of them are so interesting that I wanted to present my own version of it. And mostly because I read a lot of material about them. Here again, I grew up hearing about William, and then I started reading about Alonzo when I got involved in that campaign to get the Medal of Honor. And there's a lot of information, actually, about both of them, but I found that most of the books are very dry. I mean, factually, they're filled with a lot of good information, but as a read, they were sort of like, unless you're a history buff, they weren't much fun. So I thought, let me try and infuse a little humanity into these guys and present their accomplishments.
So Heroic Brothers of the Civil War, book focuses on two brothers, exploits fighting for the Union. Would you favor us by sharing an excerpt?
Yeah, sure. I think it's funny because the two pieces – the first piece is called The Last Man, which is about Alonzo, and which is interesting because that's the first one, is The Last Man. And then the second piece, the last piece, is The First Seal. So I guess literally The Last Shall Be First, The First Last. But I think I really enjoy the opening to the First Seal, which is about William. Simply because it really does connect the two much better. And that's where... So the opening to the First Seal is, Navy Lieutenant William Barker Cushing, Will informally, became the first in his family to learn of his brother Lon's death while fighting in the Battle of Gettysburg. Will was at Naval Headquarters in Washington, D.C. when couriers delivered word of the battle, its victorious outcome, but also its losses. He was a deck officer for the USS Minnesota, a blockade ship cruising the mouth of the Roanoke River in North Carolina, when the messenger interrupted briefings to deliver the news. 2 years earlier, in July of 1861, he affirmed his dedication to Lon by proclaiming, "If the rebels should kill him, I should become a fiend." In many ways, that is exactly what he did, just not the way he planned. Upon hearing of the death, Will requested a transfer from the Navy to the Army, hoping for command of the 4th Artillery to honor the brother he loved so dearly. Fortunately for the Union, and in many ways history, the Army did not cooperate, since Will achieved unlikely feats of daring throughout his naval career. So that sort of opens up the story about Will.
Tell us more about Will. I want to know more. I mean, listening to you there, give us some more. Flesh him out some more, as much as you can.
Yeah, I think the tagline of the book really sums it up nicely, because the subtitle, or not the subtitle, but the subtext is two brothers different in personality but similar in their dedication to the Union and each one's influence on the war. And they were also devoted to each other. I mean, both of them were as close as brothers could get and yet were so different in personality. Alonzo was very, very disciplined, very intelligent, intellectual almost. In fact, he started as a topographical engineer, which in the Civil War, that was where the really smart guys went. They were the ones who would scout out the battlefield and decide, all right, where are you going to place troops? How are we going to approach this? That kind of thing. But he really wanted more action, so he was very happy to – he started in the artillery, and then he returned to the artillery, and that's where he died as an artillery guy. William, impetuous, willful – just made it up as he went along, and yet somehow always came out well. I mean, so they were very different in personality, and yet both succeeded unbelievably well in the time that they were serving. Obviously, Alonzo, he was only 22 when he died. Will was that old, but he certainly made it to, you know, his 30s. So what
specific behavior led him being dismissed from Annapolis?
Yeah. Will was one of those guys who, here again, he was not very disciplined. He didn't follow orders very well. And he also, he was never afraid to let people know if he didn't respect somebody, even if it was his superior. And so he was always getting in trouble. He was always accumulating demerits as he went along, and finally in his senior year, he did something to one of the faculty members who actually he had always plagued this guy through the years, but he finally did something that the superintendent of the academy just said, no, I can't let this go, so they dismissed him. But what happened was then it was only a few weeks later that the Civil War broke out. And the Navy needed people so badly, they said, okay, we'll reinstate you as a midshipman, because midshipman is actually a rank in the Navy. And then he just very quickly proved himself as one of the most daring warriors they had. Now, it's interesting because, and this is one of the things I try and bring out in the book, is that the Navy did blockade duty. Pretty much that was it. That was the extent of the Navy's involvement in the Civil War. Well, blockade duty, for anybody who's ever done it, and I have to a degree, it's boring. It's routine. You're just going back and forth making sure nobody gets through. He wanted action. So a lot of times he'd go out and do something on his own completely, just get tired of sitting around, and he would pull something off. Well, the Navy was always trying to get him in trouble, but then whatever he did succeeded so well, it would get reported in the newspapers. Like, well, what are we going to do? Are we going to put this guy in the brig who's a big hero? So the Navy finally said, all right, it's obvious you're not going to obey orders. You're not going to listen to us. So just let us know what you're up to so we can plan, and, you know, and we'll let you. He would handpick his own guys and go out. And this is why I say the first SEAL, because in many ways he was a commando-type warrior, where he would take a small unit, a small detachment. They had one particular thing in mind, and they would go do it however they could do it.
Now, you're writing about a very well-documented historical period. So how did you go about ensuring this historical accuracy in a sense in terms of
well,
your depiction of what took place?
Well, a lot of reading.
Okay. Right.
Several books on both of them. I actually have many of their letters, you know, in family possessions. I have Will's journals, his personal diary. So I had a lot of that to go off of. And then a lot of it I have to credit Paul Hemphill, who I think has been a great help. He writes extensively on the Civil War, and I would send him stuff as I went along, and he would correct me where I was wrong and say, no, that's not the right number or whatever. So he was a big help, you know, just bouncing it off other people who were very familiar with the Civil War, especially the Army part. Now, the Navy part I had pretty well covered because, like I said, I've got much more on Will than I did on Alonzo. But it was just a lot of homework.
But tell us more about Alonzo's story. He died young at 22, you said, right?
And to get into some of the stuff, I think one of the interesting things is there were four brothers. All four of them did serve in the Army or in the armed forces. Will was Navy, obviously, but all four of them did serve in some capacity. But Alonzo, I say he was always very focused, very disciplined. And it's interesting because their mother once said that Alonzo would be the one to take care of her in her old age, which actually became true in that because Alonzo died on the battlefield, his mother got a pension. So in many ways, he did end up taking care of his mother into her older age, even though he died very young. He was interesting in that he was one of the most promising, I mean, as a cadet. In fact, one of the things, and I think I bring it up in the book, is that they said there was no other West Point graduate moved up the ranks quite as fast as Alonzo, with the possible exception of George Armstrong Custer. Comparison to Custer with him. But Alonzo, like I say, I think the thing with him was he was so focused and he was so disciplined, but he also commanded great respect. I mean, when he died, I mean, he took three rounds before he died. He got shot in the leg and the groin. Then he got shot in the arm, I believe, but he got shot in the neck. It was, you know, like I say, the headshot is always the career killer. So, one of the things that is interesting to me was he was manning the cannons himself because he lost so many men during Pickett's Charge. And the old cannons, you had to cover up the vent hole to prevent gases from escaping. Well, they had what's called, it was a leather glove that you would put on your hand to protect your hand. Well, he didn't have that leather glove on. So he literally burned his thumb down to the bone while he was still fighting. So the guy took immeasurable wounds before he went down, and he knew he was going to die that day. He just absolutely accepted it and said, no, I'm staying here until I go, you know, I go down. So incredibly brave, which is why I think, you know, hey, the Medal of Honor definitely deserved in his case.
Please share another passage from your book.
Sure. Let me pick one out really quickly. Well, let me do this one. And here again, I'm going to Will, but I think this is one of my favorite stories about him, if I can find it. Oh, yes, here we go. Okay. This is early on in the war. Probably in 1864. So this would be in 1862. In February, Will proposed taking a contingent of men to kidnap Brigadier General Lewis Herbert, the regional Confederate commander. Once he secured permission, he took to the task with gusto. He began the mission by approaching the town from a direction that would fool those on shore that as a craft was moving downriver and most likely friendly. He got to the residence only to discover Hebert was not there. Still, he could not resist tweaking the general's nose a bit. "My dear general," Will wrote on a note card he left propped against a candlestick on the dining room table, "I deeply regret that you were not at home when I called. Very respectfully, W.B. Cushing." Even the Confederates admired that kind of brass, and several of them made note of the Navy's renegade. So he goes to kidnap a general. He isn't home, and he leaves him a note. Almost like, yeah, maybe next time.
I'll be back.
Yeah. He's absolutely incredible.
So
as
for you,
Lonzo,
for you growing up and hearing these stories, how were you able to combine factual accuracy with fictional narrative and not paint, I won't say a rosy picture of both of them, but how did you refrain from...
There's many scenarios where I knew what happened, but, you know, I kind of liken to what I do, to sort of plagiarizing Tom Wolfe and The Right Stuff.
Okay.
That, you know, the conversations, the way the people interact, that obviously is my interpretation of what might have happened, but the events did happen. So in many cases, I used letters they had written to family members to each other or diary entries to compose the dialogue. So when I quote them, the quotes are them in most cases, not every case, but in most cases. But it might not be in that scenario. It might have been lifted out of a letter or a diary entry, something like that.
So as you think about the two characters and your two relatives here, in terms of the moral and ethical dilemmas that they did face, I mean, that's going to be a lot to grapple with to think about, I mean, especially during the Civil War.
Well, it's interesting because Lon was much more devoted to the anti-slavery movement than Will. Will just wanted to be in the Navy. That was, you know, I just want to fight. I don't care who.
Okay, who it is? I just want to fight. All right, I got you.
Where Alonzo was, I think, much more religious, and people understand that the anti-slavery movement was a religious movement to begin with, and so I think Alonzo was much more devoted to the freeing of the slaves than Will was. Will was just—he was a warrior, and he wanted to fight, and that was—he was happy as long as he was doing that.
So how did William meet his demise? How did William die later on?
They think it might have. Nobody's really sure, but he did give his body such a beating. I mean, he was 32 years old when he died, and he just he was stationed in D.C. and he just collapsed, and a couple of days later he died. So it might have been any number of things. They don't really know for sure because obviously medical knowledge was not that good back then. But the theory seems to be that he had beaten his body up so often in so many ways that it just finally, it could have been a heart attack. It could have been any number of things. So
now, as you think about the reception in terms of the book, how have readers reacted to your portrayal of the Civil War?
Very
as well
pleased.
As the story itself.
In fact, it's still doing fairly well on Amazon, at least for Civil War naval operations. It's still in the top 100. I think one of the nicest words I got from it was that, yeah, you don't have to be a historian to enjoy it. And that was sort of the point of bringing history alive, making the people there real and not just figures. This is the event, this is what he did. No, here's the motivation behind it. I mean, in many ways, Will was, I think, one of the interviews I did when the book was coming out, the guy asked, he said, do you think he might have been like a psychopath? I said, yeah, it's highly possible because the guy had no fear of death. I mean, it was almost an irrational lack of fear. I mean, when he sank the Albemarle, which, of course, is the big feat he accomplished, he's just standing right up on deck, and they're firing bullets at him, and he's taking shots through his clothes and around him, know, it just, I kind of, if you think of the character in Apocalypse Now, the, what was his name, Colonel Kilgore, that Robert Duvall portrays.
Yes.
It's kind of like that daring that, you know, I'm invincible. Nobody's ever going to touch me. So, whereas Alonzo was much more aware of it.
What did you learn about yourself from writing this book?
Well, I think one of the things is, of course, and here again, one question I got at one point was, since you were named after William and you were in the Navy like him, do you share any qualities of his? I say, well, other than getting in trouble in school, I don't think I can make many claims to bravery this guy displayed, or Alonzo. I mean, we all like to think that we would do the things they did, but, you know, when push comes to shove, are we going to? I kind of doubt it, and I think that's what makes these two so admirable. That, you know, like I say, Alonzo knew he was going to die. It's almost inevitable that he was aware, this is it, this is my last day on the planet. Let me make the most of it. I don't know how many of us could actually pull that off. And with Will, the way he could adapt and adjust to changing circumstances, I mean, even if his mission, proposed mission, failed, he somehow came out of it with some sort of success. There was one incident where he went to do one thing. It completely failed, but he was able to capture a Confederate courier, and by taking the mail that the guy was delivering, he got a lot of intelligence, you know, on arms, you know, the troop strengths, all this other stuff. So he could turn what seemed to be a failure into a success.
So as you think about being a writer, a poet, all of the above, what advice would you give someone if they were attempting to take on a project like this in terms of writing historical fiction?
Well, I and here again, I used earlier Tom Wolfe's book, The Right Stuff, as an example, but I think that's a great exemplar. Anybody who reads that book, I mean, it's so wonderfully written. And I tried to replicate sort of what he did in this, although obviously a much shorter, I mean, this is only a 55-page book, including illustrations. I guess the big thing is this book started out much longer than it ended up.
Okay.
And I think that's part of the poet in me, is like, let's cut back to what's really essential to make the story interesting. You know, cut off. In fact, that it's funny because one of the reviews I have on Amazon, the guy, his only complaint was, I wish it had been longer. I was like, well, it's not that way. It just didn't end up that way. But I think, I don't know, probably, and now just sit with the, or just stick with the poetics of it, and I believe, was it Eliot who said, make it your own? You know, that, okay, you're taking something. I mean, there's a bunch of books written about both these guys, but how am I going to make it distinctly mine?
Right.
And I think that's what I was trying to do, and that's what I think anybody should do. I always loved, John Gardner once said that there's no new ideas, that the job of the writer is to take whatever's already there and make it applicable to your own generation. And so I think that's what I was trying to do here as well.
Now, do you plan to write another, a different take on the Civil War based on these two your cousins?
No, not that. I think I've done this, and that's all I'm going to do in this direction. I am back to writing short stories. I'm working on one now about World War II. I've got several short stories on, one on the Trojan War, one on World War II. I'm working on a second World War II short story. And then one of my writing colleagues in my writing group pointed out, says, you know, nobody really writes about Korea. And I'm going, that's a good point. I think I'll approach that next. So, and no timeline on it. But I do like trying to take actual historical events. One of the ones I'm working on now, it's really in very early stages, but there was an earthquake in Peru back in 1971 that completely buried a small town. And these people, I mean, talk about having a bad day. They had a tsunami Of course, the tsunami caused the earthquake, and then the earthquake caused a mountainslide, which buried the town. It was a small farming town. So I'm writing that from the point of view of one of the people that lived in the town, of what it might be like to go through this.
Would you mind sharing one last passage before we go? I'd love to hear.
Sure.
I want to know more.
Yeah. Well, let me... Well, here's one. Okay, I'll... I'm trying to find... Oh, here we go. Okay. So this is, like I say, the sinking of the Albemarle is what Will was most famous for. It was an ironclad Confederate ship that nobody could seem to get at. And they finally said, well, let's give it to this guy. He seems to be able to come up with ideas. And he did. He designed a sort of torpedo. Because what he did was he took a very small boat with a torpedo on a spar, on a very long spar, that could be exploded with a trigger. And what he did was he basically, here's this big ironclad ship and this little small boat, this cutter is coming at him, and they're thinking, well, what is this guy doing? What's he hoping to accomplish? Well, they didn't realize that, yeah, he was sneaking up underneath the thing. And this is after the explosion tore a gaping hole in the ship's bottom and sent a tall column of water around its hull and into the air. Wool's plan seemed to have worked, but his own boat was severely damaged as well. He held a final command, every man save himself. Wool and the others dove into cold water while being pelted with grape shot from rifles and muskets. Once in the river, Wool swam until exhausted, crawling ashore. He could hear several Confederate search parties pass close by, but was only discovered by a slave who'd been ordered to seek out any Union sailors he might happen upon. Naturally, the man was not as enthusiastic in completing his task. When Will saw the black man standing over him, he asked what had happened back at the berth of the CSS Albemarle. "She is dead, gone, sunk," the slave told him, "and they will hang you if they catch you." So that's, you know, sort of how he completed that task. Not that it was the last thing he did, but that was his major accomplishment, was sinking the Albemarle.
You know, I commend you, Bill, for trying something new, stepping outside maybe a comfort zone in terms of the writing to write a book. I mean, about a well-documented period of time. But also having those members in your family. I mean, to check and see who was in my family.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe we all do. So,
yeah, you're named after this guy, and about the guy, the more you go, man, there's no way I'll ever measure up to this one.
In my mind, you're already there, my friend.
Thanks so much.
All right, then. Well, I'd like to thank you. Anything else you'd like to share with our audience before we go? Where can we purchase Heroic Brothers of the Civil War?
Well, here again, it's on Amazon, which, you know, you can get directly. Or, once again, if anybody wants signed copies, it's also available through Southern Arizona Press, who's the publisher of it. And he actually published my last book of poems and also a book of my own memories, which is called Time Well Spent. But, Amazon is available directly through me if anybody would like a signed copy. In fact, hey, I just thought of it. Father's Day is coming.
What better present? Well, look, I'd like to thank you for being with me. I'd like to thank Chuck Corbisario I wish you both the best.
Well, thanks
hope
for
see
giving
you
us
soon.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Thanks for having us.
All right. Have a nice one. All right.
Bye.
Take care, Bill.
Bye-bye.
All right, everyone.
Still craving poetry? Hundreds of episodes of the Quintessential Listening Poetry Online radio and YouTube podcast are available to listen to or download on iTunes, Spotify, and other streaming platforms. To learn more about this popular podcast or how to become a guest, visit www.qlporyt.com. Till next time, take care and let poetry ring somewhere throughout the land.